Chapter 23. Summer, over here. Stepping off the train from Great Yarmouth with the travel bag over her shoulder, Summer had to scan the crowded platform a moment before spotting Julie standing to one side, waving her hand in the air. Thanks for meeting me, she said, greeting the researcher with a hug. I'm not sure I'd find my way out of here alone, she added, marveling at the massive covered rail yard of the Liverpool Street Station in northeast London. It's actually pretty simple, Julie replied with a grin. You just follow all the other rats out of the maze. She led Summer past several station platforms and through the bustling terminal concourse to a nearby parking lot. There they climbed into a green Ford Compact that resembled an overgrown insect. How was the voyage down to Yarmouth? Julie asked as she navigated the car into the London traffic. Miserable. We caught a northerly storm front after leaving Scapa Flow and faced gale-force winds during our entire run down the North Sea. I'm still feeling a little wobbly. I guess I should be thankful I was able to fly back from Scotland. So what's the latest on the mystery of the Hampshire's sinking? Summer asked. Have you established any connection with Lord Kitchener? Just a very few loose threads. Quite tenuous at best, I'm afraid. I checked the Admiralty's official inquiry into the sinking of the Hampshire, but it was a banal white paper that simply blamed destruction on a German mine. I also examined the claim that the IRA may have planted a bomb on the ship, but it seems to be without merit. Any chance that the Germans could have planted a bomb? There's absolutely no indication from known German records, so that seems unlikely as well. It was their belief that a mine from U-75 caused the sinking. Unfortunately, the U-boat's captain, Kurt Beitzen, didn't survive the war, so we have no official German account of the event. So that's two brick walls. Where are those loose threads that you were talking about? Summer asked. Well, I carefully reviewed some of my documents on Kitchener and rechecked his military war records. Two unusual documents cropped up. In the late spring of 1916, he made a special request to the army for two armed bodyguards for an unspecified reason. In that age, bodyguards were something of a rarity, reserved for perhaps only the king. The other item was a strange letter I found in his military files. Stopping at a red light, she reached into a folder on the back seat and handed Summer a copy of the letter from Archbishop Davidson. Like I said, they are two flimsy items that probably mean nothing. Summer quickly scanned the letter, wrinkling her brow at its contents. This manifest he refers to, is it some sort of church document? I really haven't a clue, Julie replied. That's why our first stop is the Church of England's archives at Lambeth Palace. I've ordered up the Archbishop's personal records in hopes we might find something more substantial. They crossed the River Thames over the London Bridge and drove into Lambeth, where Julie parked the green Ford near the palace. Summer absorbed the beauty of the ancient building that fronted the water, with Buckingham Palace visible across the river. They made their way to the Grand Hall, where they were escorted to the library's reading room. Summer noticed a thin, handsome man smile at them from a copy machine as they entered. The archivist had a thick stack of folders waiting when Julie approached the desk. Here are the Archbishop's records. I'm afraid we had nothing on file related to Lord Kitchener, the young woman declared. Quite all right, Julie replied. Thank you for searching. The two women moved to a table and split the files and then began poring through the documents. The Archbishop was a rather prolific writer, Summer noted, impressed with the volume. Apparently so. This is his correspondence for just the first half of 1916. As she attacked the file, Summer noticed the man at the copy machine gather some books and take a seat at the table directly behind her. Her nose detected a dose of cologne, musky but pleasing, which wafted from the man's direction. Taking a quick glance over her shoulder, she noticed he wore an antique-looking gold ring on his right hand. She flipped through the letters quickly, finding them mostly dry pronouncements on budget and policy directed at the subordinate bishops around Britain, along with their in-kind replies. After an hour, the women had both weeded through half of their piles. Here's a letter from Kitchener, Julie suddenly announced. Summer peered anxiously across the table. What does it say? It appears to be a response to the Archbishop's letter, as it is dated just a few days later. It's short, so I'll read it to you. Your Excellency, I regret that I am unable to comply with your recent request. The manifest is a document of powerful historic consequence. It demands public exposure when the world is again at peace. I fear that in your hands the Church would only bury the revelation in order to protect its existing theological tenets. I beg of you to recall your subordinates who continue to persecute me ceaselessly. Your obedient servant, H.H. Kitchener. Whatever could this manifest be? Summer wondered. I don't know. But Kitchener clearly held a copy of it and felt it was important. Obviously the Church did too. Summer heard the man behind her clear his throat, then turn and lean over their table. Pardon me for overhearing, but did you say Kitchener? He asked with a disarming smile. Yes, Summer replied. My friend Julie is writing a biography of the Field Marshal. My name is Baker, Ridley Bannister lied, obtaining introductions in return. Might I suggest that a better source of Lord Kitchener historical documents may be found at the Imperial War Museum? Kind of you to say, Mr. Baker, Julie replied, but I've already exhaustively searched their materials. Which brings you here? He asked. I wouldn't expect a military hero's influence to stretch very far into the Church of England. Just tracing some correspondence he had with the Archbishop of Canterbury, she replied. Then this would indeed be the place, Bannister said, smiling broadly. What is the nature of your research? Summer asked him. Just a bit of hobby research. I'm investigating a few old abbey sites that were destroyed during Henry VIII's purge of the monasteries. He held up a dusty book entitled Abbey Plans of Old England, then turned again toward Julie. Have you uncovered any new secrets about Kitchener? That honor belongs to Summer. She helped prove that the ship he was sunk on may have had a planted explosive aboard. The Hampshire, he said. I thought it was proven that she had struck a German mine. The blast hole indicates that the explosion originated inside the ship, Summer replied. Perhaps the old rumor of the IRA planting a bomb aboard may have been true, he said. You know the story behind that? Julie asked. Yes, Bannister replied. The Hampshire was sent to Belfast for a refit in early 1916. Some believe a bomb was inserted into the ship there and detonated months later. You seem to know a lot about the Hampshire, Summer commented. I'm just an obsessive World War I history buff, Bannister replied. So, where is your research taking you from here? We'll be going to Kent for another pass through Kitchener's personal papers housed at Broome Park, Julie said. Have you seen his last diary? Why, no, Julie said, surprised at the question. It has always been presumed to have been lost. Bannister looked down at his watch. Oh, my, look at the time. I'm afraid I must run. It was a delight to meet you, ladies, he said, rising from the table and offering a faint bow. May your quest for historical knowledge meet with profound fulfillment. He quickly returned his book to the librarian, then waved goodbye as he left the reading room. Quite a handsome fellow, Julie gushed with a grin. Yes, Summer agreed. He was certainly knowledgeable about Kitchener and the Hampshire. That's true. I wouldn't think too many people would be aware that Kitchener's last diary went missing. Wouldn't it have gone down with him on the ship? Nobody knows. He traditionally captured his writings in small bound books that covered the period of a single year. His writings from 1916 were never found, so it's always been presumed that he carried it with him on the Hampshire. What do you make of Mr. Baker's claim that the IRA may have bombed the Hampshire? It's one of many outlandish assertions that arose after the sinking that I've found has no historical justification. It's difficult to believe that the Hampshire would have been carrying a bomb aboard for over 6 months. The IRA, or Irish Volunteers as they were known at the time, certainly wouldn't have known that far in advance that Kitchener would set foot on the ship. They didn't actually become a very militant group until the Easter Rising in April of 1916, well after the Hampshire had left Belfast. More telling is the fact that they never actually claimed responsibility for the sinking. "Then I guess we keep digging," Summer said, opening up a new folder of the Archbishop's papers. They worked for another hour before the stacks grew thin. Nearing the bottom of her last folder, Summer suddenly sat upright when she read a short letter from a bishop in Portsmouth. She read it a second time before passing it over to Julie. "Take a look at this," she said. "The parcel has been delivered and the messenger sent away," Julie said, reading the letter aloud. "The item of interest shall cease to be a concern within 72 hours. Signed, Bishop Lowry, Portsmouth Diocese." Julie set the letter down and gave Summer a blank look. "I'm afraid I don't see the relevancy," she said. "Look at the date." Julie gazed at the top of the letter. June 2nd, 1916. 3 days before the Hampshire sank, she said in a surprised voice. "It would seem," Summer said quietly, "that the plot has thickened."